There we go. Ready? I'm on. Thank you. Okay. I'm an addict, and Dwayne's my problem. I want to start this out by giving you a little history on how I made it here today. I was in a little meeting in the state of New Jersey in a basement on a cloudy, rainy day. There was eight people in there, and there was a man called Greg. You guys remember the volcano? Shut down all the airplanes. Nobody could come back home or get anywhere. Well, Greg just happened to be in this basement. And I was sharing, and he told me he was from Denmark, and I offered him a ride. If you need a ride, come give me a call. We'll get you around. I know it's kind of rough. And he says, let me have your phone number. And I'm like, okay. No, what for? You live in Denmark, right? He says, no, I want your phone number on the convention committee. I said, well, he liked what I shared. I said, okay, that's great. Here's my number. Go ahead. Well, 3 months later, I get a phone call. And I don't know if you have people that call you and try to sell you things. So I have the iPhone, you know, I'm part of the generation. And so I look up the area code and it doesn't register in America. The first three numbers are not there. So now I know for sure whoever's trying to get a hold of me is trying to sell me something. So he gets on the phone, and I don't know about you, when somebody tries to sell me something, I turn into a detective. Who is this? What do you want? You're who? Oh, hey, hi. 5 minutes into our conversation, I realized he was calling for this guy, Greg, which I had totally forgot his name, and he asked me if I would speak in Denmark. With that said, then my paranoia sets in. Is this for real? Am I really going? What do they want? I'm really playing around in my mind with this because, you know, I've got some time in the program, and you guys are either lucky or unlucky because you're getting a first-time review with me trying this on this level. So take it at the end of the day and let me know. Some people ask me how I got the commitment. And I really wanted to hold off on telling you that story until you got here today because I think it's just a beautiful story to show you that you can be sitting in a room full of seven people and 7-8 months later end up in another country wondering what the hell you're doing here. I don't wonder. I know my higher power really took care of me, and I'm going to tell you my life story here in a minute, and hopefully you'll see where he took me from the depths of hell and actually given me a chance at life. So with that said, we'll go into the story. I was born in 1953 in New York City. My mother left me with black babysitters in Harlem during that period of time because she was a lesbian and it was frowned upon, and she was single. And she left me there for 7 years where I grew up in the black community. Now, if you know anything about Harlem and New York and a white kid, it just doesn't fit. The literature says we always felt like we didn't fit in. It gets better. Besides the growing up, which I felt prejudice on the other side of the fence, which is kind of rare for a white kid in America to feel that at that in that era of the 60s. But the real kicker is it was done there. She wanted to ship me off to her parents now. And I don't know if you ever heard of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, but it's Yamish country where they ride around in horse and buggies. I went from the middle of hearing trains all night long to hearing nothing. I couldn't sleep. I damn sure didn't fit in again because I'm wild and wanting to fight and wrestle everybody. That didn't go on. I chipped my tooth chasing somebody on the monkey bars. But a very horrible thing started happening to me at that point. You see, I didn't know at the time, and it took years later in recovery to figure what was going on. My grandfather was a drunk. And my step-grandmother was neurotic and strung out on speed. Now, back then, they gave out pills in bottles said for sleepiness and tiredness. That's all they put on them. And what happened was I would get beat in my sleep at 7 years old because my grandmother was so whacked out of her mind, she thought that I was doing something wrong all the time. If she found cellophane ripped in a closet, she thought I was playing with matches and would beat me until I admitted that I did it. This was what my first 8 years with this lady was like, until they died, and I took care of them until they died. The first time I got any recognition that I was okay is when my grandfather petted me on the head and said, "You're a good boy." But that's after we already buried her. He was Scandinavian. He was first generation from Sweden. His last name was Nordgren. He was one of 18 kids. He went through the gamut. I took care of him till he died. Now I entered another phase of my life. It's called foster care. I was put in the state of New Jersey, and I had to go to different foster homes. But if you could figure it out by now, I'd had enough. So if you want a poster child for an addict, I'm going to tell you why. Because at that point, nobody could tell me nothing. You weren't my parent, you weren't my mom, you weren't my dad, and I was living in a home, and I didn't care. For me to get attention and to get recognition and have somebody like me, I would steal stuff. My first thing was a newspaper stand. They laid their change out there every day, and every day I would take it on the way to school and smile at the crossing guard as I crossed the street. I was in sixth grade. Then I would steal baseball cards. Then I would steal yodels, and I'd give them to my friends. What I was doing is now all of a sudden people liked me. But that was in my first foster home. I did three foster homes. I stole from the first one and wondered why they kicked me out. I came in one day and they threw me out of the house. Said, "You have to go. We have another kid coming. You've got to go to another foster home." I have a problem opening up a refrigerator in somebody's house because I don't feel comfortable. I don't know if you've ever been put in another home, but it's a very uncomfortable position to be in. I had more criminal charges by the time I was 19 that I always liked this part of it. I was going to Trenton State and not to college. What I mean by that, I was heading to state penitentiary at the age of 19. See, the only person that could tell me what to do at that age was the judge. The judge was like my father. Every time I got in front of him, I figured I got to a point where, okay, I did something wrong. In other words, I got caught. Nothing before that mattered. I knew I was doing something wrong, but inside I had a lot of hurt and a lot of anger. Instead of going to prison, I went to the United States Army and I spent 7 years in Germany. On my way there, at 19 years old, I knew I had to stop using. My friends weren't my friends. I wasn't allowed in people's houses. They didn't like me, and they had good reason to. And they weren't laughing with me. They were laughing at me. Because every time I got arrested, I would tell them about it, and we'd have a nice little joke about it. But really, I was getting more and more alone. So I figured when I joined the Army, I would do the one thing that I thought the world would accept. I was a biker. I still am. So I became a jock. I don't know if you know what a jock is. That's somebody that's always involved in sports. And we had like this image thing going on where you couldn't wear white socks. So I bought my first pair of white socks in 1976. And I worked out all the time. I joined the soccer team, and I played in the soccer team against the Germans. And I did all these wonderful things. And I looked around for NA. I heard there was a place you could go, but all I could find was AA. There was no literature. I was looking for a book. In 1976, you could not talk about being a drug addict because you were called a narc. You did not come out like today. Everybody can tell you, "I do drugs." Back then, you didn't talk about it. You shot your dope and you hid in the corner. That's what I did. So I did it for like 2 years. I stayed straight in the Army without a program. But even then, I knew I needed to make amends and apologize for all the shit I did. But there was just no outlet. So what happens? I met a girl. Didn't know nothing about friggin' program. And it was a German girl. And she wanted to know what it was like to get high. I had 2 years clean, but I knew a little something. I was 19 years old shooting dope and selling it in my high school. I knew a little bit about getting high. I said, "No, you really don't want to." "Oh, yeah, but I do. I want to have a good time." Okay, here we go. Here we go. My Army career is in the middle of it. I'm on my second post. I showed her how to get, I didn't have to show her. I think she was getting high before I met her. But anyway, we end up getting high. I end up selling all this friggin' hash and becoming this big man on post and everything else. Needless to say, that marriage did not work. Less than a year later, we got divorced. And she was pregnant by somebody else, but I'd love to say it was her fault. I wasn't around because they caught me in the whorehouses all the time. There was two, it's legal in Germany. I mean, I'd go there and my friends would go tell her where I was and they'd have a good time with her and I'd be over there and that'd be the end of it. But I tell you, it didn't play out that way in my mind. I just told you I sold drugs and I had a little organization going on, and my friends wanted to do something about it to the guy. I said, just leave him alone. I went back to America after 7 years and decided I'm going. And you know how we get the fuck it's? Well, I had 7.5 years in the military. I went back to my fort and I said, fuck it, and I went AWOL. And they wanted to beat this guy up, and I said, no, leave him alone. And all I did was inadvertently beat up myself and use more and more and more. I went to Albuquerque, New Mexico with a bag of guns. Got locked up because somebody tried to make them feel that they were better than me. Like, this is my house, you do what I say. And I told you I was a foster kid, so I didn't take that very lightly. I don't like feeling bad that I owe you. So I went to hurt him, and the cops came. And I ran. And they were saying, he's got guns. I'm hearing this on the radio. I'm hiding in a dumpster. We're cool, right? I'm hiding in a dumpster. I said, oh, they're going to shoot me. So I went to the nearest traffic light where there was a phone and stood there so they wouldn't shoot me. They locked me up. They said, next morning, just leave town, please. Just go back to New Jersey, go back to the Army, but please just leave. Okay. So I came back to New Jersey, and I felt like all the friends that when we leave and we come back, they don't know that you've changed or did anything special. They just remember the person that left at 19. So for a long time, I tried to resist that. No, I did more than that. I was a sergeant. I stayed clean for a couple of years. I don't really... Let me tell you, I used to tell people, what are you doing this to your body for? You know, when we use drugs? Come on, man, you got to take care of yourself a little bit. I became worse than any of them. I fell right back into the addiction that I left to the point where I was going to blow my head off. And I don't know about you, but have you ever had a relationship that you shouldn't be in? Every time you hooked up with them, you got arrested? Well, I had a girl like that, and I was getting ready to blow my head off. We're cool. I got one bullet. It's for me. All right? 357. I got one bullet. It's my bullet. Guns load in my mouth, and who knocks on the door but the one girl that I'm not supposed to be around. I'll always be grateful for her to reminding me not to kill myself. She just showed up. God sent her. The angels that come in your life are sent not by you, man. That girl saved my life or I wouldn't be here today. But I didn't stop right then. I ended up doing something that I regret. I used to beat up people for beating up girls. That was my thing because I thought it was wrong. Well, I crossed that line with her. 2 months later, I was sitting in rehab in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and all I wanted was the white sheets. I don't know if any of you guys have ever been in jail or ever been like in the Army, but those crisp white sheets, I just wanted to stop. I 31 years old is when I first asked for help. I'm 53 now, and I've been clean ever since. That's 22 years. Yeah. Yeah, I feel the goosebumps, huh? That's pretty amazing. It's I hit the white sheets and all I wanted to do was relax. I just needed to be unplugged. And I didn't believe in rehabs, and I'll tell you why. I didn't believe in this program, and I'll tell you why. I had foster brothers, and every time they went in the program was to get out of doing time. Every time they went in the program was out to get out of doing time. They would do it, and I didn't know any better. They'd come out of prison and come out of the program. I have a keg waiting for them and crank in the refrigerator. Welcome home, and wonder why he's skitzing on the couch. I had no idea that I was doing that to him. In rehab, they said wonderful things to me, like, you got to do this. And I tell them, no way, but I'll try it. And then they told me they liked the idea that I tried it. In my life, I was told all the time that I am no good. You'll never be any good, and I gave them a reason at the end of the day. One thing that kept me from blowing my head off as a little kid is there's a movie called Father Flanagan, and it's about Boys Town. And I remember as a kid watching TV as I was getting all these beatings, and the statement that this TV said to me was, there's no such thing as a bad boy. And when I got shot in the face in my addiction and got off the ground, the first thing I said to my higher power was, I guess I'm not as bad as everybody says I am. I got clean 2 years later. What I'm leading up to is I brought my basic text, and in it is written from a bunch of people from my rehab telling me that I'm okay. I'm glad to meet you. I wish you luck. I hope that you make it. Thanks for helping me. For the first time in my life, I slowed down long enough to do a first step. I had to put things in order. this happened to me at this age, this happened at this age, this is where I went, and wonder what the hell I was going through, because my life was a freaking whirlwind, man. I was just trying not to get killed or kill somebody. And when I read this book, I cry. Because inside my deep soul, inside in here, is still hurting, thinking I'm no good. It's still there. After 22 years, that thing can still come up. I can watch a friggin' TV program and just start bawling. My wife laughs at me. In a good way. Like, ah, you're sentimental. I would love to read you a lot of these things, but all I'm telling you is that it helped heal me. And as I came into the program, I ran around like a nut. I don't know about you, but it was important that the people that served in the meetings were there every day, every week that I went there. Because I can tell you, if that chairperson wasn't in that meeting, I would have told you you're full of shit and I'm out of here. Because I was looking for change. And if you were full of it, I didn't even hang out with you. I didn't like people coming up to me, quoting me the book, and they couldn't tell me what it felt in their heart. I really didn't have a lot of time for that. I would just say, you know what, just get away from me, man. I didn't like the idea that people would sit in meetings and get real descriptive about shooting dope, because I know how to shoot dope. I don't need you to tell me about it. I got 22 years clean, and I cannot watch that on TV. I'm not saying that you can't. I can't. I cannot watch the act of drug use because it still flips my stomach, and I don't like that feeling. I just can't handle that. I just got to step out and just leave me alone. I got involved in service work, and in 1990 and 1991, I was programming chair for the New Jersey Regional Convention, and back then we had the Purist Movement going on, and it's like, if it's not written in NA, you really can't talk about it in meetings, and I was a little rebellious, so we'd have these big, I put like 64 meetings on in one weekend, and they would fight some of the topics, but some of the topics that they were fighting was staying clean on the outside, parenting and recovery, illness and recovery. And I can tell you, we had that AIDS meeting back in 1990, and the guy is no longer with us, but everybody cried in that meeting afterwards. There was a guy named Ron H. that had his first, I waived clean time so he could get out and talk about what it was like to get out of prison. Because when I meet guys getting out of jail, I step to them all the time, and I let them know one thing. If you want to stay here, man, you really need to lose that jailing attitude. You know, this is a place where we're going to hug you, man, but you give up the jailing stuff, because a lot of guys getting out of jail just don't make it here. They just get caught right back up into the whole sneaker thing. Never mind, that's an inside joke. What happened was, at the end of this convention, because I don't know if you guys, when you get in service, it's like a thankless job. I got my feelings hurt. It wasn't, I guess I was looking for recognition that what a wonderful job I did and everything. And so I stepped away from service work for about 10 to 15 years. But I can tell you where the rewards came. The rewards came later on in when you go to the conventions now, or you look around the fellowship, now you see those topics are inbred. They're there. So don't tell me one person in this program can't make a difference, because if it needs to be here, God will put it here and it will stay here. I'm telling you right now. So take your commitments and do the best you can in your belief systems. I'm drawing blanks here. Anyway, besides all that, I remember coming into my new area and having like 9 months clean, and there was a group of people that thought they were going to be my sponsor. I'm going to be your sponsor. They're telling me they're going to be my sponsor. And I don't know about you, but selecting my sponsor was told it's got to be somebody I admire that has something I like and something I want. So that took a process. And I was talking to somebody today. I don't know about you, but we didn't do the mailing list where you get your phone numbers on it. You had to go up and ask for them. And that took months of me going to, we had activities. You guys had this meeting today about how to help the newcomers. Well, we have dances, we have picnics, we have boatings, we have fishing trips. So I would do all these little things. And I saw this one guy attending all these meetings. So one day I got his phone number and I called him. And all I could say was hello. I didn't know what else to say. I didn't know what else. I'm going to back up to the home group thing. Anyway, to keep me coming to meetings, there was this cute girl at this meeting. She was the chairperson of the meeting. And you know how we're not, I don't know, in America we're not supposed girls with the girls, guys with the guys. I mean, that's supposed to be the rule. Well, every time the meeting list went around, I would take one number off the meeting list with her number on it. It's what I knew. And I take it down. I called her once, and all I could say was hi. It's as far as I could go. What the hell do you do when you're not getting high no more, man? Hey, you want to go smoke a joint? I mean, that's out of the picture now, ain't it? I mean, hey, you want to go hang out at the bar? I mean, there's no lines after that. We laugh about that today. We really do. There's been a lot of things that has happened to me in this program. I have two kids and a wife that when I met my wife in this program, we weren't supposed to make it. We were broken up. She called me and told me she was pregnant. Guys, what's our first line? Not mine. Wasn't mine. What are you talking about? We were broken up. I went back to rehab to give somebody a coin. And I thought I was going there to give them a coin. Well, I told somebody what I was going through, and they said, you should stay. No, I can't stay. I got no money. I got a job. I got to get back. Probation's going to violate me. I can't just. He says, don't worry about it. Go take care of all that shit and come back. We'll pay for it. Well, 2 weeks later, I went back to intense therapy, came back. I was main speaker at my home group. And in the middle of this home group, I proposed to my wife. We've been married for 18 years, and we've been together for 20. Thank you. Thank her. I have a 19-year-old son and a 13-year-old son. I have never, ever hit them. They told me in recovery, the buck stops here. I have a choice. I can carry on the madness or the insanity and take it into my family, or I can do my best right now to stop it right now, right here, and not pass that on. I went through a lot of phases with my kids. Like when they were 7, my mother left me. My 13-year-old, I want to put him through a wall. The first one I would have 10 of. Perfect child. Listens, yes, da, da, da. The other one argues every friggin' thing I say. Everything, and he's smart and quick. Can't do that. Why? Well, this is going on. What about that? No, you can't do that either. Oh, but they're home. Forget it. I give up. Recovery has afforded me the ability to develop something. And I just told you I was a junkie, strung out person of the worst kind. And we talked about perception in the public today in your meeting with the H&R, with the PI stuff. And I wanted to blast it out then. I have coached soccer in the state of New Jersey in Princeton area for 13 years. I've got 2 felonies. I'm one more felony and I'm locked up for life. I am teaching PhD kids, their kids, these parents, and they love me. They love me. We've had 2 titles and 2 second places in 13 years. That's not a bad record for somebody that wouldn't even be allowed in these people's doors. And my inadequacies are there. I'm a junkie with a Princeton address. Now, you need to think about this. I don't know about you, but Princeton's a very prestigious place. And I was going to go get a house because my friend Tom in the front here helped me buy my first motorcycle, and then he pissed me off. I got a resentment because he wouldn't let me park. He said, yo, you can park the bike here anytime. Don't worry about it. Then he started to get, remember I told you I beat up that guy for making me feel inadequate because I owed him? Well, I didn't beat him up, but I said, screw you, I'll go get my own house. Resentments work, people. I know they say they're bad. I know they tell you, be careful, and that's true, you know. Fuckets will get you high, but in this case, every resentment I've had with that guy, my life's got better. We ended up building a house in Princeton, and here's how we think. I can only afford this much to go get a house. I'm going to get a garage, and every house is like this. I'm looking at for what I can afford, and I'm telling people I don't have the time to fix it up. I ain't got the money. It'll never happen. But then God shows me this other thing. Well, what about this? And we weren't even supposed to get this house. It was a lottery, and we were 13. They were only giving away 10. Tell me about HP. HP just knocked the other 3 out of the way and put us right in that 10th spot. NA built me a house. We had to put these hours in. Everybody thought I was dealing drugs, all the other people that were building their houses. How do you know all these people? Oh, don't worry about it. You know how we get. We want to be mystique, mysterious. Yeah, I got this. They're friends. So they built this house. I have pictures in my basement right now, on my first floor, of everybody building the house all through this whole process. And I feel inadequate in this town because all these people are like very rich, and I am very poor. But I always got to remember my higher power put me in that spot. When I go to church and I sit there and I look at all these people well-dressed and well-mannered, I think, why am I here? And I start feeling inadequate. I always got to come back to the fact that my higher power put me there, no matter how I think how bad I am still. I still drive I got my first motorcycle in recovery. I don't know about you guys, but I wanted a bike my whole life. I'd step out of the bar, say, I'm going to get one day, go right back inside and blow it all up my nose. All right, that one of them fucking things, man. That's right. In my mind. Got the t-shirt. I'm on my second bike and it's paid off. So it's been one step at a time. And I just can't tell you, there's no coincidence. This whole, me sitting in this chair right now is the whole second step in a nutshell. We had to do drills in early recovery, and we do it as a game. We drive each other around, call ourselves winners. You know, if you got 1 minute after 12, we'd call each other and say, we're a winner, we did a meeting we didn't use today. That's like my first 90 days we did that. We drive all over. And where's that going with that? Don't know. It's time to change. early recovery. It's not like me. Anyway, that guy's back clean too. Facebook's a wonderful thing. This guy that was in early recovery, he'd be all over the place, and he used for the last 20 years. He's got a year now. When you talk about the newcomer not coming back and leaving you and disappearing, just always be here with them. Because I had 2 years clean in the military when I couldn't find the program. And of course, I told you I used, but I never forgot what it was like to be straight. So when I see people now and they've been gone, and people say, oh, this one and that one, this one and that one, I say, I don't care. I hope I'm here 10 years from now if they make it back, so I can give them a hug and say, welcome back. It's not about judge. I still got people that are using that call me. So what? You know what I mean? I mean, I'm not going to go hang with them, but I never turn my back on them. I really believe that. I used to have, here's a story. I had an apartment, and I thought I was cool. It was early recovery, and this girl relapsed. Bad thing. Okay, it really was. I was upset about that, but she gave me brand new furniture. So I'm thinking, God, life recovery is great. Brand new furniture. Here's the hit on that. The furniture wasn't meant for me. And here's what I really believe. HP knew that I would take care of the furniture and the place I lived so I could put the person that was kicking dope on that friggin' couch for weeks at a time. My place became like a rehab. They would come and kick, and I'd have these rules. Stay out of my bedroom. I cook, you clean. And I don't know about you, but when you piss off an addict in this program, like you throw a son of a bitch out when they're not doing what they're supposed to, like you had enough and they're using you. I don't know if you know any addicts that use you, but I threw them out, and next thing you know, I'm dirt at the meetings. That son of a bitch threw me out. Rah, rah, rah. Boundaries are important to us here, and they're not always comfortable to make. NA is growing, and I'd like to talk about your area, and from my position with 22 years, what I see. You guys are at a cusp of breaking it loose, and I pray for you. I really like what I see here. I remember when we were at that stage. You ever hear the old-timers talk about, I remember in my day, and I'm an old-timer, and I got all this stuff to say. And the only thing that I think that was different from the old-timers to the new people is we had like 8 people in a meeting, where you might have 30. With 8 people, it's easy to say, Peter's missing, where the hell is he? Why don't we take a ride and go find him? You know what I mean? Let's hunt him down. Everybody seen Peter? And he might be getting high. All right. We're going to fuck up his high. I'm going to get something out of it. I'm not going alone. We got 5 guys in the car. We got nothing else to do. It's 3:00 in the morning. We're not weak. We're not tired. We're going to go find Peter. That's another thing. How much drugs did we do to stay awake? Tons. I'll tell you how to stay awake around here. I went camping. There was a girl I wanted to be with, and I stayed up for 3 days. It never happened. But I was awake waiting. We were camping. You know, our camping days, I don't know if you guys camp, but that just heightens the whole thing. Nobody can see me. I can be sneaky. Let me tell you what else I learned on that camping trip. I don't know about you, but I have this inadequacy about feeling broke. And I'm sitting in the woods and I have no money in my pocket. This is like 90 days. I'm in the Pine Barrens of South Jersey, swamp water, everything else going on. And I'm feeling really bad. I have no money. All my money's gone. Now I'm feeling, you know, it's like running out of drugs. You know that feeling? You know, that empty, useless, want to shoot myself kind of shit. So I'm sitting at the meeting, not the meeting, in the woods. I told you who I'm chasing, that ain't happening. I got no money, so now I'm really feeling bad. But here's the bottom line. I smoked back then, had a carton of cigarettes, I had a friggin' tent that I borrowed, and I had food. I learned in less than 90 days that I had everything I need right then and there. I didn't need the $5 in my wallet. I didn't need any of it. I had it right then. Now, the story about the tent's another thing. I broke the guy's lantern. The tent rolled into the fire. I had to bring it back to his house. And I wasn't that well in recovery. I just threw it on his porch and ran. Thank God he was a good friend. I think I owe him an amends. A financial amends. Anyway, I think we should talk about steps. All right. Step one, and I'm not going to spend all day on it because you guys all have your own thing. When I got here, there was no book to do the steps on. There just wasn't. There was just different ways to do it. And then we get to some of the people in my area that have 5 or 6 years. They try to tell everybody that if you don't do the book, you're doing it wrong. And my reply to that, and they like to throw this word in, predecessor. My predecessor. I thank my predecessor. Well, thank you. You're welcome. Well, the bottom line is there's a million ways to do the steps around here, and there is no wrong way. If you take the time to look at yourself, you're doing the right thing. First, you got to have the sponsor. That would help. Not necessary, but it would help. The second step I told you about is we had to do these drills. I remember in early recovery, I woke up one day, and I had a plan. I don't know about you. You wake up, we have a plan. I'm going to do this, this, and this today. Before 9 o'clock in the morning, I was 2 states away doing something. So that taught me that I'm not in control. Because I remember when I used to work for Del Monte and I tried this recovery thing the first time, it didn't work for me, and I thought I was in control. What I found out in the minds of civilian people, you put 5 guys together, they're smarter than me. If I'm a criminal, they'll figure out what I'm doing. I can't bluff them all. Third step, I was told like this. Dwayne, it's really simple. We got wise asses in the program. I don't know if you have them here, but I have them in New Jersey, where they can tell them 3 words that make you listen. He says, the third step is really simple. It's like you get arrested. You have a choice. You can either get beat up, thrown in the back of the car and hit your head, or you can just pay attention, get in the front seat, and I'll drive. But either way, you're heading in that direction. And of course, we know about the fourth step. The fourth step's really good right in the beginning of a relationship. That's usually when we want to start doing some changing, or right after one. That really will motivate you to finish it. The fifth step, my sponsor was really understanding, because the girl shared last night, there's certain things we carry that we think is so shameful that we're the only one that ever did that. And when we release that, then we become all kinds of, we're free. We don't have to, you know that thing where we don't look nobody in the eye no more? Well, somehow after that fifth step, you can start looking anybody in the eye at any given time, and it really doesn't freaking matter what they think about you. And then the defects and the shortcomings are just a matter of knowing what they are and knowing that you can't take them away. I thought for a long time I could change my own shortcomings. I could, and it just doesn't work that way. Where are we at, 8 and 9? All right. They're going to happen in the weirdest places. You're going to be shopping. First, you make the list. I took it from my resentment list, carried it over, because at this point, I owned that I was a jerk off in most of those things. It was my fault that these relationships went south. I blew a lot of good relationships. Maybe I'm going too fast on these steps. But when you run into people, they're going to happen in strange places. Like, I'd be in the middle of a mall shopping. John will walk by. Hey, John, from my past. And I'll walk 3 aisles over, stop, damn it. I'd have to go back and find John now because there's something on my list. like you won't always find. You can find the easy ones. You can do the financial. You can. I wouldn't recommend telling the courts what you did. It's probably not a good idea. But the way to make that up is like I trained over 300 kids, so I gave back. I don't train criminals no more. I train young men. So you have to run back. I had to run back, and I make these amends to people as I see them along the way. The 10th step is a great pamphlet. I like that pamphlet, IP, Living the Program. 11th step, improve my conscience. That's hard for me to shut my mind up. I mean, it's not always possible for me to listen to his will for me, you know, and get back to me and try to guide me. And most people just remember the part of the 12th step, helping the other addicts. But the spiritual awakening is all these little things, and they don't come all the time. I don't know about you, but I was shopping once. And I was putting stuff in the basket, and I bought my son a bicycle. Just the fact that I knew that I could buy him a bicycle and not break the bank, and I didn't worry. Me not worrying is a moment where I feel peace. I don't know about you, but I used to do a lot of drugs to OD just to feel peace. My whole thing was to try to die doing them so I wouldn't feel this worry no more. In here, my spiritual awakening is those moments when I'm not worrying, where I feel calm inside, and it's just, I don't give a damn what happens right now. At the end of the day, I'll be okay. This last year, my third step's been worked the hardest because my financial status has gone like this, and I just got to know at the end of the day, like I was in the woods with no money in my wallet, that at the end of the day, I'm going to be okay. I'm done speaking. That's it. I'm done.